There are times, I'm afraid, when God is too good to Israel. All week long it was spring and warm, and we had a high school ski and study weekend planned for this weekend. So all week long, Rabbi Roth and I had a little circle praying for snow, for cold. Which is my way of saying that God must be delighted to see you here this morning in this bitter sub-zero weather. Moses had three lives. His first life was his real life. And we know nothing about that life. There are no eyewitness accounts of it. You may recall that some 50 years ago, the famous German philosopher and doctor, Albert Schweitzer, wrote a book which he called The Search for the Historical Jesus. In it, he tried to use all the accepted canons of scholarly research. And his conclusion was that though most of what was told about the man Jesus seemed to fit the time and place and the character which is described, actually, all of the documents come from several generations later. They are the product of an oral tradition, and that not a single fact about the life of Jesus can actually, factually be ascertained. And the same must be said of Moses. Almost all of the elements that our Torah tells us about Moses have verisimilitude. That is, they seem to be appropriate to the 13th century before the Common Era. And obviously there was an experience in Egypt, and someone had to bring the Jews out of Egypt and bind them to some kind of covenant law structure once they were free people. But actually, though there's no reason to doubt the historical Moses any more than there's reason to doubt the historical Jesus, about the men themselves, their real lives, as pure scholars, we can say nothing. The second life of Moses is the life with which you're familiar. The details of a man as told to us in our Torah. The great liberator, the great lawgiver, the great leader. The details of this biography are well known. Not only are they the most significant of all the biographies of all Jews who've ever lived, but annually we reread our Torah. And four of the five books of the Torah deal with the life of Moses and with his teachings and with the words of God which he transmitted to the people. And so we know pretty clearly the details of the second life of Moses. The life of Moses as told in our Torah. The third life of Moses is his legendary life, his post-biblical life, his midrashic life. The life which he developed at the hands of thousands of sages and theologians and folk preachers over the centuries. Some of these men were interested in elucidating the rather enigmatic and curt and imprecise phrases of the Torah to fill out and to embellish the picture. Others were eager to read back into the most significant biography in our people their own ideal of religious personality. And they gave to Moses the virtues which they were trying to inculcate into their congregations and into themselves. And there are others who simply used the figure of Moses in order to increase an audience's interest in a good tale, to make a point. And I've long been of the feeling that if one were to segregate out all of these stories about Moses that are post-biblical, the third life of Moses, and place them in their time and place and analyze them, one would be able to write a history of the development of Jewish thought, which would say a great deal about the inner spirit, the basic belief, the elemental attitudes of Jews at a particular moment in time. And someday, God willing, I hope to write to that book. And I've already begun to root about in the material. And this talk this morning is by way of a first report on one interesting and illustrative little vignette that I found there. I was reading several months ago The Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. It's a long history of our people which begins with creation and runs down to the first century of this era, written by the Jewish Benedict Arnold and Will Durant, Flavius Josephus. Josephus lived in the first century. He's an interesting fellow. He was a Pharisee, he was something of a scholar, and he was something of a military man. And when the Jews planned to rebel against Rome in the year 66 of this era, Josephus was given command of the northern garrison of the troops in the Galilee. And he fought a number of skirmishes against Rome, and he decided on the basis of these skirmishes, of the Roman military firepower, the might which he saw there, and the own weakness of his troops, the weakness of his arsenal, that the Judeans would not be able to be successful, and so he surrendered to Vespasian. Now, if you want to be a Benedict Arnold, to surrender your troops without battle, do it with seichel. And Josephus, whatever other virtues or vices he may have had, had seichel. What did he do? When he came to bend the knee to Vespasian, he offered him his sword, as was the custom. And then he looked up and he said to the Roman general, "You know, Vespasian, that prophecy is rooted here in Judea. All agree to that. And a voice has come to me which says that you will be the King of Kings, the Caesar." Now, a Roman general was not averse to hearing such agreeable portents of the future. And he filed it in the back of his mind, and 2 years later, the prophecy turned to be true, and Vespasian was crowned acclaimed Caesar in Rome. And one of his first acts was to send to Judea to find the military hostage, the slave Josephus, and bring him to Rome and free him. And Josephus spent the last years of his life, some 30 years, at the Roman court, where he was a courtier, where he spent his time writing this great history of the Jews and a number of apologetics, mea culpas, explanations of his act as Benedict Arnold. Well, in the course of this history, he obviously must tell the life of Moses. And the life of Moses that he tells follows the familiar chronology. There's the birth during difficult times when no Jewish man-child may survive. There's the plan of his mother and of his sister to put the baby in an ark which will be carried down the waters of the Nile. There's a fortuitous discovery of this little child in the ark by the daughter of Pharaoh. There's the fact that she brings the child into the palace of Pharaoh and raises him there as if he were her own son. And then a new incident is introduced into the chronicle, one which does not appear in the Bible, one which, as far as I know, has no parallel in Palestinian sources at all. And this is the way Josephus tells that incident. During the early years, the adolescence, or late adolescence of Moses, men of the south attacked Egypt. And they found that the Egyptian defenses were weak. They were surprised by this. All they'd come for was some booty, some plunder. And so they decided that they would renew their attack and they would try and conquer all of Egypt. And these were bad days for the Egyptians, and a dispirited Pharaoh went to the oracle, the gods. And the oracle told him that he must, to save his country, appoint the young prince Moses as general of the Egyptian defense forces. And once this was done, the gods would support Moses, and he would be able to lead a successful attack against the Ethiopians, and so it was done. And Prince Moses was appointed as general-in-chief of the Egyptian armies, and he began to plan the strategy, the tactics of a campaign against the Ethiopian frontiersmen in the south. Now, if you want to march south from Egypt, the normal way of march is to follow the banks of the Nile River, which will take you directly to Khartoum and to the major cities of Ethiopia. But Moses was afraid that this way would be ambushed, would be surrounded by the Ethiopian troops. And so he determined to take the way through the wilderness. But it was a difficult and perilous way, the way that was rarely followed. Not only was it a parched way, was there little water, but the way was surrounded by the pit holes of the aspen, of the adder, of the serpents of all kinds. And troops did not like, were afraid to march through it because these serpents were believed to be poisonous, dangerous to man, fatal. And so Moses decides that he will take the interior way because he counts on surprise to overwhelm the Ethiopians. And he has a second strategy, a way to clear the route in front of him of these poisonous serpents. What does he do? According to the story, he prepares a number of baskets made out of wicker, and he places in each of these baskets a bird, an ibis bird, a bird who is famous for his appetite and for being a predatory bird which attacks the snakes and the serpents. And he takes these birds with him south, and when they come to the land where all the asp and the adders and the serpents are, he unleashes these predators, and they act like his minesweepers. They clear the way, and he's able to come in unexpectedly from a quarter which was undefended to attack the Ethiopian strongholds and to overwhelm them. Now, this story is retold by Josephus as emes, as truth, but it's obviously a story. But what's its basis? These stories were not simply inventions. They had to have some reason for being besides the creative imagination of the writer. Well, it's easy to understand why such a story of Moses as a successful general might be told. Josephus lived during the heyday of the Greco-Roman cultural world. And this world had one common concept of the virtue of the truly heroic and truly noble man. And that concept was expressed by the word agathē, a Greek word, which meant the man who was disciplined and who showed his wisdom and his discipline in three ways. First, he was skillful in wisdom. He was acknowledged by all to be understanding and wise in judgment. Second of all, he was wise and skillful in politics. He was able to promulgate just laws for his community and to organize it in security. And thirdly, he was successful in strategy in battle. He made for the political and military security of his country. Now, the first two elements in agathē, the elements which have to do with political leadership and with wisdom, are obviously elements which are part and parcel of the biography of Moses as we know it throughout the Bible. But whenever the Bible describes to us Moses as a general, the actions of the armies of Israel, it makes it very clear that they're going out and they're coming in, to use the biblical phrase, that they're going out and coming in was under the direct governance of God. Moses is simply the agent of God here. It is God who is the shield of Israel. It is God who is the protector of the host. Only as long as God commands the people to make war do they make war successfully. And if they try to make war against God's will, they are defeated. Now, if one wants to prove the agathē, the virtue in Greek terms of Moses as general, one must find a campaign in which he was significant, the leader, before God commissions him to lead Israel, that is, before the burning bush and the return to Egypt. And when could this have been? Only when he was a young prince at Pharaoh's court. So obviously, if you're going to construct such a story, Moses must be in command of an Egyptian army, and this army must be given over to him. That's the basis, apparently, of the story. Now, why does he go south? Why does he attack the Ethiopians? Why doesn't he go against the Philistines or against the Arabian people, the people of the Sinai wilderness, who will be his enemies when he leads out the children of Israel much later? Here the explanation seems to be a strange, elliptic, enigmatic phrase in the Bible itself. The Bible tells us in the fourth book, in the book of Numbers, chapter 12, verse 1, if you want to look it up and check me on it, the Bible tells us that when the children of Israel came to a certain place in their wanderings called Hatzeret, Aaron and Miriam spoke out against Moses because of the Cushite woman, because he had taken a Cushite as his wife. We know nothing else about the woman. We have no idea why Miriam and Aaron should speak out against Moses for having taken the Cushite as his wife. All that we do know is that in biblical times, the word Cush was the equivalent of Ethiopia, and that the biblical phrase would have indicated to the editors of the Bible, to the commentators and those who read it, that Moses had taken an Ethiopian wife. But where would Moses get an Ethiopian wife? not in Egypt, where the Ethiopians were looked down upon as rude frontier folk, not in Sinai, where the Ethiopians never came, and certainly not in the area of Jordan, which was most of the area of the wilderness wandering. Now, if you've got to construct a campaign about Moses as general of an Egyptian force, and if you know that the Ethiopians and the Egyptians are constantly at war, what's more natural than to make the Ethiopians the enemy, the object of the tactics and the strategy which Moses planned so successfully? And that midrashic purpose seems to be behind the use of the Ethiopians as the enemy. But what do we do with these ibis birds? Aye, that's the question. And when I came to this problem, I found that I really didn't know what an ibis bird was. I'm not very much of an ornithologist. And I went to the books, and I discovered that an ibis bird is a marsh bird, a wading bird. It has the long legs of a crane. It tends to have largish wings, a rather ugly, misshapen neck, and a very, very long bill, with which it scoops up the frogs and the other insects on which it lives. In Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, the word for ibis, I discovered, was magalan, which means a scythe-like bird, a bird whose beak is shaped like a scythe. And these birds were common in the marshlands along the Nile. They're common, I understand, in our own southland, in the marshes and the bayous of the south. So I want to discover the role of the ibis bird in Egyptian religion and in Egyptian history. And I went first to the Greek historian Herodotus, who visited Egypt in the 4th century BC, and I discovered that Herodotus tells us a good bit about the ibis bird, including the fact that he was a known predator, he lived on serpents and snakes, and that the Egyptians said that whenever the winged serpents flew in from Arabia, the ibis bird gobbled them up one by one before they could attack the crops of the Egyptians and destroy them. So he was known as a bird which was the natural predator who ate naturally the serpents and the snakes of this area. And then I found in a Roman zoologist by the name of Aelian, who lived in the 2nd century of the Common Era, that he had been told many things about the ibis bird, including the fact that the ibis bird was known as an extremely patriotic bird. According to the Egyptian traditions, the ibis bird never left Egypt. And this suggested to me the second possible purpose of this story of Moses and the birds, and that it was part of a polemic, a rather interesting polemic, debate, violent debate, defense and attack, between the Egyptians and the Jews in the 1st-2nd century before the Common Era and the 1st-2nd century of our era. Let me tell you a bit about their struggle. Jews had lived in Egypt for many centuries. We know that the Jews came down with Egypt after the destruction by the Babylonians of Jerusalem in the 6th century. We know that the Persian ruler Cambyses established late in the 6th century Jewish mercenaries, paid Jewish troops, on the island of Elephantine, which is an island which has become famous in recent times because it is a place of Aswan, the great Aswan Dam. And that this Jewish garrison remained in place for several hundred years, its purpose to prevent Egypt from being attacked from the south by the very Ethiopian peoples of whom this story tells. And we know that the major contingent of Judeans who came down to Egypt were brought by one of the generals of Alexander the Great, who proposed to create in Egypt a great Greek capital, the city of Alexandria, the city of Alexander, a port city from which the Greeks would be able to rule all of Egypt and rule it with security. Now, the great source of insecurity for a city-state of the Greeks was its own restive lower-class population. If you read Thucydides, you read Herodotus, you recognize how much the leaders of Greece were threatened by the restlessness of their own lower classes. And this was particularly true after Alexander went out and conquered the world, because the lower classes were always the natives, those the colonials, those whose power had been taken. So they wanted to create Alexandria as a safe city, That is, a city without locals, without natives. And they brought great drafts of Judeans down from Palestine, and they settled them as a craftsman's group, as a laborer's group in Alexandria. Some 100,000 were brought down. And Jews were the major element in the lower non-aristocratic population of the city. Now, Alexandria, under the Ptolemies, under these Greek Egyptian rulers, prospered greatly, became the greatest city of the Near East. And of course, this Judean class that had been brought down began to prosper with the city. Now, the Egyptians, the natives who saw the Judeans imported, freed, and now prosperous, obviously looked upon these Jews as someone who had usurped rights, privileges, which were normally their own. The very basis of much of anti-Semitism from that day to this. And one of the earliest Egyptian literary sources which speaks of the Jews was written by an Egyptian priest by the name of Manetho, sometime in the late 3rd century before the Common Era, in which he attacks the Jews, and he does so by taking Jewish history and distorting it. He makes Moses into a traitor, into a man who had been a priest of one of the Egyptian gods, Seth, the god of the underworld, the devil god, who was untrue to his priestly role, who was driven out from Heliopolis, the great shrine city, who went to the area where the Egyptians kept the lepers, all of their unwanted people, who raised them in a great rebellion against the Egyptians, who brought them back and occupied the country for 17 years. During this period of time, according to Manetho, the legitimate ruler of Egypt fled to Ethiopia. The Ethiopians now become not the enemy, but the friend. And he took with him all of the sacred animals of Egypt, including the ibis bird. And after 17 years, he was able to, with his allies, the Ethiopians, march back into Egypt and drive the Mosaists, the Judaists, out and force them into the wilderness. The Exodus is not the freeing of Hebrews from bondage and their escape into freedom. It is the destruction by the Egyptian pharaoh of a revolt, which had been raised against him. That's the story that essentially Manetho tells. So he too knew of this Ethiopian attack, but he had twisted and turned the story so it becomes part of an anti-Jewish polemic. Now, apparently, part of the story as Josephus tells it indicates that the Jews were not at all disloyal, but loyalists to the end. If the ibis is a bird which will not leave Egypt, if it is the ultimate in the patriotic among all animals, obviously it will allow itself to be used for purposes outside of Egypt, a campaign against the Ethiopians, only by one who is loyally serving the pharaoh. And we have here a symbolic indication, claim, that Moses, far from being a disloyal priest, was in fact the loyal general of Pharaoh. So we have an element of the polemic in this story. But there's still the possibility that the ibis bird, you know, research is fun, because research requires you to go down every highway and byway that's possible before you think you've proven a case. The ibis bird may be simply a creative element, may have been invented by Josephus simply because it makes the tale a little more appetizing to the reader. So I researched all of the earlier Jewish writers, and I found in a man named Artapanus, an historian who lived in Egypt in the 2nd century before the Common Era, a story somewhat similar to the story as told by Josephus. There is the generalship of Moses. There is the campaign against the Ethiopians. He does not take the ibis bird down in these wicker baskets and unleash them against the serpents. But this time, he fights a 10-year campaign against the Ethiopians, and during that campaign, he is forced to build a semi-permanent encampment for his troops. And of all things, this man, Moses, does one thing. He dedicates the camp which he builds to the sacred ibis. So apparently the tradition is long-lived. It's obviously not a matter of idle chance. Now, what does it say to us? It says to us something about the polemic. But I think it also says to us a great deal of how the diaspora looked upon Moses. There was a period of time, this is, I think, what follows from this research, as I'll try to show you, in which Moses came so close to being deified, to becoming a god, that there were in the folk, the further away they got from the large normative centers of Jewish life, there was among the people a tradition which appealed to Moses as the intercessor to bring their prayers to God, which looked upon Moses almost as if he were a son of God, God himself. We know, for instance, in these Egyptian Jewish writers, that they spoke of Moses as being one whose wisdom was such that he had brought down from the heavens the most important knowledge that man possesses. During this period of time, there were any number of great heroes, ancient heroes, founding heroes of the great faith, Zoroaster, Moses, some of the Greeks, who were looked upon as the men, the godlike men, the divine men, whose wisdom was so active, was so close to the wisdom of God, that they were the transmission belt through which the heavens, the great intelligence of which the world was constructed, by which the heavens told man what is needed. This very historian Artapanus tells us this: Moses invented mathematics and offered it to man. Moses invented the art of calculation of the months and the days and the years, the intercalation of astronomy so that it fit into a calendar, and gave this to man. Moses taught the Egyptians how to divide their kingdom into 36 nomes, 36 provinces, which could be accurately governed. Moses avoided the clanging and the bangings and had a power which doesn't belong to a modern rabbi. Moses had the opportunity during this period of time, according to Artapanus, to tell to the Egyptian priests the meaning of the sacred writings, of the hieroglyphs, which were looked upon as magical meanings, to have a power which was above and beyond that of normal writing. In brief, almost all of the tools which man possesses had been given to them by Moses. So Moses was looked upon in this environment as if he was nearly divine. And the story of the ibis, I think, simply takes this divinity one step further. At about the time that I was doing this particular bit of reading, I came across an obituary which told of the death of a man named Walter Emery. Walter Emery was one of the deans of Egyptian archaeologists. He had worked for the last 20 years of his life at a place called Saqqara North, which is near the city of Thebes. It's a great mausoleum city, a great necropolis, a place where the Egyptians for centuries had buried their dead. And Emery was working at Saqqara because he believed that he would find there the tomb of a man who had lived in the third millennium BC, a man by the name of Imhotep, the great wizard, the great magician, the great giver of calendar, of language, of healing, of all the arts that Moses also is told to have been the great progenitor of and giver of, a man who had been the architect of the first great pyramid around the year 2800 BC, a man who around the 5th century BC began to be deified by the Egyptians and worshipped, and the center of his worship was at Saqqara North. And what intrigued me about this was two things. First, the parallel in the careers of Imhotep and Moses. Both lived for long periods of time as men. And if my assumption is correct, both had a period in the Egyptian milieu in which they were seen as gods. And the second element which piqued my curiosity was this, that just before he died, at Saqqara North, at this place dedicated to Imhotep as a shrine, Walter Emery had broken into a number of subterranean caverns. And in these caverns, he had found, packed floor to ceiling, great clay vases, each of which contained a mummified ibis bird. His field records indicate that there may be as many as a million mummified ibis birds in these caverns, which he did not completely excavate. Now, why was the ibis bird brought to Imhotep's shrine? It was a sacred bird. It was the image of a god in ancient Egyptian religion named Thoth. And during Greek times, Thoth and Imhotep had become, in a sense, one and the same person. Now, this god Imhotep was the scribe god, was the protector of justice, was the legislator god, was the god who established the seasons and the great ceremonies. And his way was very much the way of Imhotep. So they brought the ibis bird as an offering. And they hoped, having brought this offering to the god, that the god would give them healing or immortality, or at least would pay greater attention to their prayers. The one bit of writing which he found in all these caverns was a little ostracon, that is a piece of clay, baked clay, whitewashed on one surface, which has writing on it. And in this particular bit of demotic, that is late Egyptian Greek writing, they found underneath the symbol of an ibis bird, the prayer that so-and-so, one of your most humble servants, O Imhotep, requests long life, healing, and immortality from you for this gift. So there was a shrine to which the ibis was sacred, a shrine where the individual brought his needs, prayed to this man become God, this great ancient leader, wise man, sage, lawgiver, architect, who had suddenly been deified. And all of this seems to have a close relationship to Moses. No, we don't know of any place in which the ibis bird was brought as a sacrifice to Moses. The Bible would preclude this because the pelican, the ibis family, is not one of the families of birds which are to be sacrificed to God. But there's a strange story somewhere else in Josephus. It tells of the only temple ever built by Jews to God outside of Jerusalem. And by temple, I mean the only place which had priests and sacrifices, which was established as a central sanctuary. In the second century, the early second century before the Common Era, there was in Egypt a man by the name of Onias. He was a feudal landlord. He was a Jew. He was commander of a group of mercenary Jewish soldiers, professional Jewish soldiers. And he applied, according to this story, and the story is really just three documents, three letters, one from Onias to Pharaoh, one from Pharaoh to Onias, and the third, Onias' final response. The first document requests of Pharaoh for services rendered. He'd obviously used his men, his money, his materiel in one of the Pharaoh's wars. Requests of Pharaoh a place called Leontopolis, or Bubastis of the Fields, where he wants to establish a temple to Adonai, a temple to God. The second letter, which comes back from the bureaucracy of the Pharaoh, says, Onias, you deserve this place, but why do you want it? There are many places in Egypt that you can have, and Leontopolis, this place, is known to be dirty because so many mummies are buried there. So many sacred animals have been buried there in the ground. Let me give you a clean, virgin piece of land. And the third letter, which comes back from Onias to Pharaoh, says, no, please give me this piece of land. This is the land that I want. The suggestion I would make about this correspondence is that Leontopolis may have, in its early years, been a place at which Moses was worshipped, because there is, in the documents of Leontopolis, a great emphasis on Moses as a central figure of the cult, in which the ibis bird, the sacred animal which dirtied the place, according to Pharaoh's bureaucrats, was buried there after it had been brought, and that these documents are, in a sense, forgeries, written after the fact when someone complained about offering an unacceptable fowl to Moses, who is an unacceptable god. There's a kind of syncretism, of primitivism, which Jews would not, have not tolerated. But the suggestion, the suspicion remains that in the early days of Leontopolis, this temple which should never have been built because it was built outside of Jerusalem, where a priest class ruled, which was tolerated because Onias had power, not because it was legitimate, that this had originally been a place where Moses was venerated as a central figure in a cult. And if this whole research lead anywhere, it helps us to understand one of the strange paradoxes of our tradition with which you are familiar. And that is the strangeness of the story of the Exodus of Egypt as it's told in our Haggadah. Every Passover, we sit down and we read the Haggadah at Seder night. And we relive the delivery of the Jews from Egypt. Have you ever noticed the fact that we do so without the story once reminding us that Moses was the liberator? The name Moses never appears in the Haggadah. Now, why not? He was there. He went to Pharaoh. He brought God's word. It was Moses who demanded, "Let my people go." It was Moses who brought them to the Red Sea, who led them into the sea, who brought them to Sinai. Can you imagine telling the history of the Exodus, of the liberation, without its central hero? Obviously, this could be done only by a group, the Pharisees, the rabbis, the central sages of our people, who were determined to drive home a lesson. And what lesson could it be? That it is God who delivers. It is God who redeems. It is through the agency of God, not the agency of any man, that freedom was established for our people. Remember the great poem that features the God of the Dayenu? How they parse down one by one all the acts of deliverance, and it's always, "Which thou, O Lord, hast done for us." Never which you did through Moses or which Moses did for us. The emphasis is on God the Redeemer, God who redeems. We are in his debt, not in the debt of Moses. And I submit to you that this tradition would never have evolved if it had not been for the fact that there were in the Egyptian Jewish diaspora, in these centuries just before the founding of the Haggadah in its present form, there was a tradition which venerated Moses as nearly divine, if not a divine being, which had a cult which we would call Mosaistic, where Moses himself was worshipped with divine form. And the fact that our people pulled back from this, even though this was a great era in which the idea of men as gods was not at all scandalous, Christianity grew in this era. Our people, burdened, blessed, call it what you will, by the second commandment, one God, no other gods, no images of gods, no one who can stand beside God, God alone being the divine. Our people pulled back from this syncretism and said, "No, no man is the ultimate hero. No man has complete agate, complete wisdom, complete nobility of person. Every man is fallible. Every man is limited. Let's see men for what they have achieved, but never overvalue them. Never bow our knees to Caesar. Never bow our knees to a philosopher or an ideologue and say, 'Here is wisdom, the truth. Now let us follow it.'" We are burdened in our tradition by living as people who will never know the truth in its completeness. All we know is that God represents truth, has shown us something of the way, that we may find something more of what we need to know. But absolutes escape us, for we have only one absolute, the unknowable, unapproachable oneness, spiritual oneness of God. And so out of little embellishments in Jewish history, which you find tucked away in the crannies of a Benedict Arnold Will Durant 2,000 years ago, you begin to be able to piece together some of the great intellectual battles that our people have fought, and to understand a little bit more, at least I have come to understand a little bit more, why there are no images in this place, and why we have never apotheosized, declared any man to be God. Or put more simply, why we Jews are just a little bit cynical in our judgments of each and every great hero. Amen.